It is it's actually fascinating how some of the most intense, bitter debates aren't fought over territory or like money, but over how to read a story.
Right. It's always about the interpretation.
Exactly. And to set this up, I want to take you back to the 1980s, the Chicago Bulls. Because, well, if you follow basketball, you know Michael Jordan is widely considered the greatest of all time.
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah.
But early in his career, the Bulls coaching staff was just completely tearing itself apart over one fundamental question, which was, how do you actually run this offense?
Yeah, and it was a clash of entire philosophies. I mean, you had the head coach, Doug Collins, whose strategy was remarkably simple, like just give the ball to Michael Jordan.
Just hand it to the star.
Right, make the entire game about the star player because, well, he is the undeniable center of the franchise.
But then you look at assistant coach Tex Winter, and he passionately argued for a team-based system. Like he wanted the famous triangle offense.
Right, the triangle offense.
Where the ball constantly moves from player to player, creating this really complex, interconnected web of decisions. And the disagreement over whether to focus on the lone star or, the entire system, it got so toxic that Collins actually banished Winter from the bench.
That is just wild to think about.
I know. And management eventually stepped in. They fired Collins and replaced him with Phil Jackson. And Jackson, of course, leaned into that interconnected system and went on to win six NBA championships.
Yeah, and you know what's fascinating here is that tension between focusing entirely on the main star versus focusing on the collective movement of the team. It is the perfect lens for our topic today.
It really is.
Because theologians and scholars have fought an incredibly similar heated battle over ancient texts. They've been specifically focusing on whether a narrative should be entirely about the ultimate hero or the messy, interconnected human elements.
Which means you are about to explore the fascinating Christ-centered preaching debate. The sources for this deep dive come from a really compelling academic lecture by Dr. Stephen D. Mathewson.
Yeah, focusing on how experts interpret and preach Old Testament narratives.
Right. And our mission today is to uncover how scholars extract meaning from these ancient stories and how they balance everyday moral instruction with grand overarching themes, and ultimately help you, the listener, learn how to read complex narratives without losing the plot.
Because how you choose to view a story fundamentally shapes the lessons you extract from it. I mean, we are going to explore historical turf wars, dramatic scholarly flip-flops, and then break down three modern buckets of interpretation.
That's a lot to cover.
It is, but reading a text isn't just about absorbing the words on the page, you know.
Yeah.
It is entirely dependent on the framework you bring to it.
So let's start with the history. Because to understand where we are today, we really have to look at where this argument first caught fire. And surprisingly, that takes us to Europe, right before World War II.
Yeah. Specifically, we are looking at the Dutch Reformed churches in Holland right around the 1930s and 1940s. The academic and religious communities there were really wrestling with how to handle historical texts.
Meaning the narrative stories of the Old Testament.
Exactly. And the community just split into two fiercely opposed camps. On one side, you had the exemplary approach.
Okay, so if you were listening to this and you've ever felt like guilty or highly motivated because a self-help guru told you to just be like Steve Jobs, you are experiencing the modern version of the exemplary approach.
Yes, that is a great parallel. Because the exemplary camp viewed the characters in these ancient stories as direct models. You know, they were examples to either imitate or avoid.
Like a blueprint.
Right. You read about David doing something righteous, and the takeaway is be brave like David, or, you know, he does something terrible, and the lesson is don't be like David.
Simple enough. Did they have like scriptural backup for this?
Oh, definitely. They pointed to New Testament passages for backup. I mean, 1 Corinthians 10 talks about historical warnings serving as examples. Hebrews 11 lists out great exemplars of faith. And the book of James explicitly says Elijah was a human being just like us, so we should pray like he did.
I mean, it sounds incredibly practical. It gives the reader an immediate, actionable takeaway. But looking at the research notes, the opposing camp, the redemptive historical approach, they absolutely hated this.
Hated it. Yeah, they believed that reading the text as a mere collection of character biographies is fragmentary. Like it turns a unified divine history into this disjointed series of moral fables.
Ah, I see.
To them, the singular focus must be on the revelation of God acting in the world, not on, you know, human behavior.
Okay, let's unpack this because I noticed in the notes that they didn't just ignore that 1 Corinthians verse about historical events being examples, they actually dug into the original Greek to challenge it. How did they justify redefining that concept?
Well, it comes down to a linguistic technicality that really shifts the entire paradigm. The redemptive historical camp argued that the Greek word used there, tupoi, does not actually mean a pedagogical example.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it isn't a teacher pointing to a student and saying, do what he's doing. Rather, they argue tupoi refers to a prefiguration, a prototype. They argued these ancient stories were structural markers pointing forward to the events of the Messianic Age. So they are a trajectory pointing straight toward Christ, not a behavioral checklist.
So it's not about David's personal bravery at all. It's about God setting the stage for a larger rescue mission.
Precisely.
I have to push back a little here, though. Isn't the redemptive historical approach kind of like, I don't know, watching a deeply emotional movie, but completely ignoring the character's personal struggles, just so you could focus entirely on the director's overarching vision?
Oh, that's a really interesting way to put it.
Because if we ignore the human element, aren't we treating the Bible like a collection of Aesop's fables on one side or an abstract museum exhibit on the other?
And that tension right there is what caused such a massive rift in the Dutch churches. Because you have the messy reality of human choices colliding with the pristine architecture of a grand historical narrative. I mean, the arguments were vitriolic.
People were actually angry about this.
Oh, absolutely. The theological journals were filled with back and forth attacks. And then the debate just vanished.
Yeah, looking at the timeline, it stops abruptly in May 1940.
Right. Because the German army invaded the Netherlands.
Wow.
Yeah. The sheer trauma and disruption of the occupation, combined with a subsequent schism within the church itself, essentially froze this theological argument in time. People had much more immediate survival concerns, obviously. So the academic discourse just went silent for 30 years.
Which brings us to the 1970s, and honestly, one of the most intriguing intellectual evolutions we came across in the source material, because the debate was frozen for decades, a massive scholarly vacuum formed. And into that vacuum steps Dr. Sidney Greidenis.
Yes. Greidenis revisited that old Dutch controversy in his 1970 doctoral dissertation, which was titled Sola Scriptura, and he developed what seemed like a brilliant, highly nuanced mediating position.
He kind of threaded the needle.
Exactly. He looked at the redemptive historical camp and agreed that, yes, narratives are not just biographies. They truly proclaim a larger redemptive plan. But he also looked at the exemplary camp and agreed that these stories contain an ethical thrust.
So they actually do tell people how they ought to live.
Right. He argued you can have both.
He found a way for history and morality to coexist, which is great. You don't have to sacrifice the overarching narrative to get a practical life lesson. It seems like the perfect resolution. And he guided a whole generation of preachers with this framework. But decades later, he executes a complete 180-degree turn.
He really did. 29 years later, in 1999, Greidenis publishes a new volume and officially abandons his own mediating position. He adopted a much stricter, more Lutheran approach.
Okay, let's clarify what that means for the listener. When the sources refer to a Lutheran approach in this context, we are talking about a theological tradition that prioritizes divine grace and Christ's work far above any human effort. Like, it carries the deep skepticism of pointing to a human character and saying, look at the good thing they did.
Right. The focus shifts entirely away from human capability. Greidenis argued that interpreters must move strictly from the Old Testament text directly to the incarnate Christ. He laid out 7 specific methods for doing this, insisting that every single passage must ultimately land on Jesus.
Wait, before we move on to how this practically works, the notes mention he used methods like typology and tracing longitudinal themes. What do those actually look like in practice? Are we talking about following a specific word through the whole text or what?
Well, a longitudinal theme is essentially tracking a core concept, like, say, the idea of a temple or sacrifice or kingship, from its earliest, most primitive mention all the way through history until it culminates in the New Testament.
Okay, that makes sense.
But typology is a bit different. It involves seeing an Old Testament person, event, or institution as a rough draft or a mold for a later reality.
Like a foreshadowing.
Sort of. For example, viewing the ancient Passover lamb not just as a historical event, but as a structural type that anticipates the ultimate sacrifice of Christ. So the mechanism is really about finding structural parallels across time.
To give the listener a concrete example of just how drastic Greidenis' shift was, let's look at the story of David and Goliath. 1 Samuel 17. It's the ultimate underdog story. Little guy, giant warrior, 5 smooth stones. But under his new strict rules, Greidenis specifically cautioned against presenting David as a model of courage.
because doing so would be falling back into the old exemplary trap.
Right.
He argued the essence of the David and Goliath story has absolutely nothing to do with human bravery. It is strictly about the Lord defeating the enemies of his people, which is a typological parallel pointing straight to Jesus' victory over cosmic evil.
I was trying to wrap my head around this while reading the notes, because so what does this all mean for the listener? If even the world's leading expert on the topic flips from saying, learn from David's courage, to David's courage isn't the point at all, it feels like the average reader is being told they can't trust their own eyes.
Oh, it completely destabilized the field of study. I mean, you have to admire the intellectual honesty of a scholar willing to publicly change his mind after 3 decades, but it left everyone wondering how to actually read the text.
Yeah, and imagine.
And this chaos is exactly why Dr. Mathewson steps back in the source material to organize this landscape into a modern framework. Because if you were trying to extract meaning from any complex text, you really have to consciously understand the lens you were looking through.
And he breaks the current landscape down into 3 distinct buckets. Let's explore the mechanisms behind each one.
All right, so bucket number 1 is the theocentric view. That just means God-centered. This approach is deeply rooted in the tradition of John Calvin, which places a heavy emphasis on the ultimate sovereignty, majesty, and attributes of God over human action.
So it's not about us.
Exactly. The primary question the reader asks is, what does this teach us about the nature of God? Dr. Ken Langley is a major proponent of this, arguing that getting distracted by human deeds misses the overarching theological point of the narrative entirely.
Another scholar in this first bucket is Abraham Kuruvilla, and he calls his specific approach Christiconic.
Yes, Christiconic.
According to the sources, he argues that the goal of studying the theology of a text is to shape the reader into the image, the icon of Christ. He heavily leans into a Trinitarian view, focusing on the complete nature of the triune God rather than just searching for Jesus in every Old Testament shadow.
Right, and Kuruvilla insists that focusing on the broad theology of the text is what actually accomplishes the goal of transforming the reader.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. I have to call out something here, and Mathewson mentions this in the lecture as well. Kuruvilla is saying his approach is all about the broad theology of God, but he specifically slaps the word Christ onto the title with Christiconic.
Yeah, he does.
It feels like clever marketing. I mean, if he's engaging in semantic gymnastics just to sneak the word Christ into a theocentric approach, doesn't that just confuse the issue further for anyone trying to learn the actual methodology?
It absolutely does, but that observation highlights a massive underlying anxiety in the academic community right now. Scholars are just terrified of being accused of not being Christ-centered enough.
Interesting.
There's immense pressure to prove that your interpretation connects to the ultimate hero of the Christian faith. So you get these complex hybrid terms like Christiconic, which Mathewson playfully points out is essentially just the God-centered approach wearing a very clever disguise.
That makes so much sense. But if the Kuruvilla approach feels too abstract, that anxiety over not having Jesus front and center naturally pushes scholars to overcorrect. They want to guarantee that the main star is always the focus, and that reaction drives us directly into bucket 2.
Yes. Bucket 2 is the Christocentric view. This is intensely focused on Jesus. Sidney Gray Danis and his 1999 flip-flop era lives here, utilizing those strict typological methods we discussed earlier.
Right.
But it is a broader category. You also have someone like Brian Chappell who offers a slightly more flexible mechanism. He talks about reading the text while wearing gospel glasses.
That's a great visual. How does that practically change the way someone interprets a text, though?
Well, the mechanism of gospel glasses allows the reader to engage with the behavioral commands, you know, the practical how to live elements, but requires them to constantly ground those commands in the context of divine redemption.
So you can't just have rules for the sake of rules.
Exactly. You can talk about human effort, but only as a response to what has already been done for you. Also in this bucket is the late Tim Keller, who frequently utilized the concept of Jesus as the better version of Old Testament figures, like Jesus is the better David or the true king.
I see.
The mechanism here is contrast. You look at where a historical figure failed, and you highlight how the ultimate hero succeeds.
Okay, so we have the abstract God focus in bucket 1, and the hyper-Jesus focus in bucket 2. The obvious question is whether there is a middle ground that doesn't feel forced. And that brings us to bucket 3.
The mediating view, also known as the Christotelic view. The word telos means the end goal or the destination. This is Dr. Mathewson's preferred approach. And what's fascinating here is it strongly mirrors the position Gray Danis originally held back in 1970 before his dramatic shift. The mechanism here is integration. It merges the immediate literary and ethical thrust of a specific story with the massive overarching storyline of the text.
There is a quote in the sources from Christopher Wright that serves as the perfect thesis statement for this approach. He says, "It all points to Christ, but it's not all about Christ."
That distinction is paramount. It allows the reader to honor the grand trajectory of the narrative without erasing the localized, immediate details of the scene right in front of them.
So we have our three frameworks: theocentric, Christocentric, and the mediating view. If we accept that this third balance bucket is the healthiest way to read these texts, mm-hmm. we really need to talk about the actual pitfalls of the other extremes. Because application is where theoretical interpretation usually goes off the rails.
Absolutely. And to understand the pitfalls, we first have to understand why this overarching narrative cannot just be ignored. In the source material, Mathewson points to a foundational moment in the book of Luke, chapter 24. It is the road to Emmaus. Jesus has resurrected, and he is walking with two disciples who do not recognize him. Jesus explicitly explains the mechanism of the ancient text to them. He states that everything written in the Law of Moses, the Prophets, and the Psalms, essentially the entire Old Testament library, ultimately concerns himself.
He is establishing the meta-narrative.
Mm-hmm.
It proves that the grand storyline exists by the author's own admission.
Yes, and because that meta-narrative exists, the experts issue very specific cautions. The first caution is aimed directly at the theocentric folks in Bucket 1.
Okay.
They must not ignore biblical theology and the grand storyline. You simply cannot fully understand a character like Ruth or Abraham apart from their ultimate connection to the overarching hero of the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Analyzing them purely as isolated moral case studies strips them of their actual historical context.
It would be like analyzing a character in a movie sequel without ever acknowledging the events of the original film. I mean, you can glean some basic lessons, but you are completely missing the structural foundation of why they are making their decisions.
Exactly.
But the Christocentric folks in Bucket 2, they come with their own severe warnings in the text.
They do. Tim Keller, despite being a major figure in the Christocentric bucket himself, issued a stark warning against a practice he called leapfrogging.
Leapfrogging.
Yeah. This occurs when an interpreter jumps over the gritty historical realities of the text just to get to Jesus as fast as possible.
So you read a complex story about ancient politics or warfare, and instead of engaging with the difficulty of it, you immediately pull the ripcord and say, "And this reminds us of Jesus."
Right. And Keller points out that doing this flattens the text. When you force every narrative to reach the exact same conclusion, every single story begins to sound identical.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And the consequence of flattening a text is actually severe. You miss out on incredibly critical, practical topics that the ancient authors intended to communicate. You lose the nuanced discussions on the dignity of everyday work, the inherent value of human life, or how leaders should responsibly handle political power. By leapfrogging over the messiness of human history, you just discard the profound wisdom meant for daily life.
It sounds like Brian Kappel's gospel glasses are helpful, but we have to be incredibly careful not to turn them into X-ray goggles. Like, we shouldn't be forcefully trying to spot hidden codes or secret meanings behind every single rock and tree in the book of Genesis.
No, and the psychology behind why people use those X-ray goggles is fascinating. It often stems from a desire for secret knowledge. Finding a hidden allegorical code feels much more profound and spiritual than simply dealing with the difficult, straightforward, ethical command right in front of us.
That is so true.
Kevin Van Hooser, another scholar mentioned in the text, warns heavily against finding Christ in fanciful, incidental details. He argues we should be tracing the central through line, the main dramatic thrust, rather than treating the text like a puzzle box to be solved.
And the sources reference Lucas O'Neill, who calls these the twin dangers.
Mm.
Missing the text by failing to honor the specific details and misusing the text by forcefully mishandling those details just to get to your preferred theological conclusion.
The twin dangers, yes.
The scholar D.A. Carson made a point in the lecture that really brings this all together. He noted that even the writers of the New Testament, the people closest to the source, they still utilize practical moral categories. They didn't reduce everything to just one single lens.
Right, they held both.
Yeah. They could point to the grand redemptive arc of history and in the next breath say, "Elijah prayed hard, so you should pray hard too." We don't have to choose between history, morality, and theology.
The ultimate goal is to hold the micro and the macro in tension. The micro is the immediate practical ethical lesson. The macro is the grand overarching narrative. You do not have to sacrifice one to appreciate the validity of the other.
Well, we have covered a lot of ground today. We started by looking at the coaching battles of the 1980s Chicago Bulls, realizing that whether it's managing a basketball team or interpreting an ancient text, the framework you use changes everything.
It really does.
Do you focus entirely on the star, or do you value the interconnected system? We traveled through the pre-World War II Dutch theological turf wars, exploring that deep divide between the exemplary and redemptive historical approaches. We unpack the incredible flip-flop of Sidney Gradanus, a scholar who spent 30 years arguing for balance before swinging to a rigid typological method.
Still hard to believe.
And finally, we navigated the three modern buckets of textual interpretation, landing on the mediating view as the healthiest way to honor both the story and the overarching structure.
Because reading an ancient text really requires a conscious effort to balance that immediate, actionable ethical lesson with the grand, continuous storyline.
Before we wrap up, we want to leave you with a final thought to chew on, something that builds on the mechanisms we've explored today.
Yeah. If the proper way to read ancient, complex texts requires us to simultaneously hold both a grand, overarching narrative and specific, actionable, ethical takeaways in our minds, what happens to a society that loses this skill?
Oh, that's heavy.
Think about our modern consumption of media and news. Do we fall into these exact same interpretive traps? Are we either moralizing every minor detail of an event to death, or are we flattening everything into one grand abstract political narrative, completely losing the human element in the process?
That's a challenging question about how we process the world around us. Keep questioning your sources. Keep looking for that delicate balance, the through line. And whatever you do, don't drop the ball by focusing so hard on the star that you miss the rest of the game. Stay curious, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.